Well, greetings, everyone. Thank you for being here, sharing this time with me. In case you haven't met me before, I'm Andrea Martin. I've been around Zen Center long enough to have studied with Dainen Katagiri, our founder. And right now I serve as his archivist, and I also edited his two most recent books. Katagiri devoted himself to studying the great Buddhist writings and then giving wonderful Dharma talks that revealed his deep insights. I've listened to many, many of those talks and been greatly moved by his teaching. But there's an odd thing, because what I remember most is his presence and the pithy phrases that he used. There are many little mottos or slogans that have made a home in my mind and keep popping up when I need to be reminded of something. These little phrases are like the tip of the iceberg of Katagiri's teaching. Most of them, such as relax your frontal lobe or walk together hand in hand, are things I heard him say many times. But there's one phrase that I found a few years ago when I worked on the light that shines through infinity. He said, "You can make an art of life." That phrase has been working on me. And also for the last year or so, I've been taking an art class. So art is on my mind. And today I'd like to think about this phrase with you. Out of curiosity, idle curiosity really, I searched the phrase, the art of, on Google, just to see what their algorithm would offer me up that day. I got the usual suspects, the art of war, self-defense, work, leadership, playing the guitar, but also the art of shaving, and a website called The Art of Manliness, which was promoting its guide to Scotch whiskey. Of course, I had to check out the website. I never did see the whiskey guide, but the site actually did look pretty interesting. I might go back and look at it again. It had some good stuff. Good for anybody. It seems to me that identifying something as an art elevates it into a realm of creativity and beauty, where its performance is ennobled in some way. Maybe there's also an implication that in order to practice that art, you had to study it with some serious intent. So I remember that Katagiri said, "You can make an art of life," but actually it's not what he said. Because when I looked it up, it turned out that what he actually said was, "You can make an art of the flow of life." And that isn't exactly the same thing. So I will come back to that. Because since I remember the phrase as "make an art of life," that's how I've been using it in my everyday life. And so I'll start there. The phrase pops up when I'm feeling at odds with myself. Maybe I'm in the kitchen or just moving around in my home, but I've fallen into a trap set by old mental and physical habits that keep me on edge. Sometimes I tend to rush unnecessarily when I'm doing things, even when I have plenty of time. I act as if time is so precious, and if I waste it in any way, I'll end up a total failure in life, because I won't have done everything on life's endless to-do list. Another habit is that when I'm doing everyday things, like wiping the kitchen counters or putting dishes away in the cabinet, I'll be thinking about the next thing I'm going to do, as if doing that thing, whatever it is, will be more worthwhile than what I'm doing right now. When these habits show themselves to me, I realize that my mind is on edge and that my movements are kind of rough. Sometimes I bump into things and drop things. I have a body and mind in which stress and anxiety built up way too easily. So I need a way to remind myself to come back to being at ease with myself. And recalling that I can make an art of life does that for me. There are other reminders that would serve the same purpose, such as wake up, slow down, pay attention, be kind, or breathe. But for me, remembering that I can make an art of life brings up a different feeling than those other things might. Those other things feel like they might be slightly critical or scolding myself that I need to fix my bad habits. But hearing that I have an opportunity to make art with what I am right now, and there's a chance to feel elevated, inspired, creative, or happy right now, is inspiring. It's like getting a supportive hug and saying, "Yes, you can do this. Let's go." Recalling that I can make an art of life helps me adjust myself, settle down, and rein in my busy mind. It's hard to say what the reset that I'm doing is exactly, but there is a shift in my attitude. So I feel welcoming to the situation, not resistant to it. There's a reorientation from stress to a relaxation that I experience as a pleasurable change in how I feel my body and mind. At the time, I feel a deep friendship with the things and the space around me, kind of an intimacy or a tender reciprocity. And then just the activity of handling things or moving through space is its own reward. Then the way I wipe the counter, handle the dishes, or walk into a different room changes. My movement gets slower, softer, and gentler. I feel graceful and a bit dignified, as if I'm performing a ritual. And simultaneously, there's an inner feeling of relief and well-being. When this happens, I feel that I truly am making an art of my life. And I also stop trying to move on to the next thing because I feel good doing the thing I'm doing right now. Making an art of life like that is different from making an art of cooking, playing basketball, or writing a poem, because there's no performance or product to achieve, nothing in particular that you can look forward to devoting yourself to. Life is everything, everywhere. So maybe the result of making an art of life is simply feeling alive and at ease, or feeling that life is worth living. Not just in a certain situation or doing a particular activity, but in every situation or activity. I know this little device of mine is not particularly profound, but I think it forms a good habit of shifting my mind toward ease. It conditions my mind with the capacity to let go of my busy thinking and experience itself as calmer, freer, or more spacious, more willing to pass by my self-centered thinking, and attune itself to awareness of some deeper or bigger levels of my life. I think this practice of moving deeper into our lives is a bodhisattva activity. When we think rationally about the bodhisattva vow to save all beings, We know it's ridiculous. But if you experience the peaceful and harmonious feeling of welcoming something into your life with a feeling of tender reciprocity, then you can get a feel for what it means. In Buddhist philosophy, there is the understanding that all beings are interconnected with each other as one being through the continuous functioning of impermanence, emptiness, and interdependent co-origination. On the surface of life, we have our own individual lives. But if we go deeper, our interconnected life is huge. Making the bodhisattva vow to save all beings arises from understanding that your life is more than just your individual life, because all beings exist with you. So you open yourself, open your heart, and welcome all beings as the contents of your life. And your life gets huge. When you welcome them, all beings also welcome you into their life, and everything exists together in peace and harmony. This deep reciprocity of identity and care among all beings reminds me of something many people say about adopting a dog from a shelter. They find their lives are made better by caring for the dog and enjoying the dog's love and companionship. They say, "I saved the dog, and the dog saved me." I think that participating in this kind of deep reciprocity is how bodhisattvas save all sentient beings. So, what about the difference between saying you can make an art of life and saying you can make an art of the flow of life? It brings to mind the Zen saying, "Bodhisattvas move from the shallow to the deep, and Buddhas move from the deep to the shallow." According to Buddhist metaphysics, flowing life energy is constantly arising from emptiness and becoming the individual forms of the human world, according to the causes and conditions that are functioning in each moment of creation. This is the very nature of creativity itself, by which everything in the universe is constantly being created and refreshed from moment to moment. That universal life force energy that is the essence of life is already present in your life. We receive this flowing energy, use it in our own individual way, and then let it return to emptiness, carrying traces of what we have done. Then the causes and conditions working in the next moment will be different, and life will change. This is how we create our lives and our world. The flowing movement of energy never stops. As long as we are alive, we are being born from emptiness. So sometimes emptiness is called the womb of Buddha. If you reach the depth of your life and realize that energy directly as your own Buddha nature, that creative energy of giving birth to something becomes available to you to use on the surface of your life. Usually we're too busy paying attention to what's going on the surface of our lives to be aware of what's happening underneath. But sometimes we feel called to move deeper, to levels of ourselves where our lives get bigger. It's from a deeper or broader understanding of who we are that we can make an art of the flow of life energy. Our art may be to move through life in such a way that energy shines through us in everything we do and is visible to others. If we become great Sambhogakaya beings like that, people feel relief just by seeing us or being around us. Sometimes the desire to express our deeper feeling for life leads us to do or create something as a process of making a connection with our original creative life in a way that we can perceive through our senses. Or it could result in the creation of something beautiful that expresses the sublime truth of life in a form that touches other people's hearts when they see or hear it, because it satisfies their own longing for the truth. When he was asked about the meaning of beauty, the renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma said, "There's that moment which essentially there's a transfer of life. It's the human cognition of that vastness, the awe and the wonder, something that's, in a way, bigger than yourself." I think any activity that requires training and intense concentration can be the occasion for experiencing a momentous shift in perception. After his semifinal match on the way to winning the Australian Open this year, tennis player Novak Djokovic said he was in the zone for the entire match. He said, "Every professional athlete wants to be in the zone, where everything flows so effortlessly and you are executing automatically everything you are intending to execute. You don't need to think too much. I guess you're driven by some force that takes over you and you feel divine. You feel like you're in a different dimension. It's quite an awesome feeling that we all try to reach and stay in." Great artists and athletes seem to be able to attune themselves to the creative energy of their lives and then transmit it to us through a form that allows that energy to be received. If you hear Yo-Yo Ma play the cello, watch Djokovic play tennis, or view an extraordinary painting, you say it's beautiful because you experience that something deeper is being transmitted to you through them, and you feel beautiful. This is what Katagiri Roshi had to say about making an art of the flow of life in terms of Zen practice. "If you practice and penetrate this very moment, you are absorbed into the flow of undefiled, clear, and pure activity. Then, when you do something, you feel something wonderful. You cannot explain it, but this is creativity in life. It's beautiful. Everything is there, melted into your form, and clear like a jewel. If you become a sportsman or an artist, you can do this in a certain area of life. But in spiritual life, it must be done in every area of life. You have to create this every day, in every daily routine. That's pretty hard. But through this form of practice, your life becomes mature, and you can live your life smoothly, in peace and harmony." So this brings me to another art that is central to our Zen practice, the art of Zazen. Ehe Dogen Zenji's famous medieval classic, Fukan Zazengi, the universal recommendation for Zazen, is a teaching essay that lays out the Zazen technique that we still practice here today, It's sometimes chanted here. And I'll give you one part of it. It says, once you have adjusted your posture, take a deep breath. Inhale and exhale. Rock your body right and left and settle into a steady, immobile sitting position. Think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. Probably when you received instruction in Zazen sitting, this is not what you heard. It wouldn't have made any sense to you. But after you've been sitting for a while, maybe you can get a hint of it. Maybe when you relax your mind away from the thoughts that are always coming up and renew awareness of your breathing, you enjoy a little feeling of relief. Once you settle into steady awareness of breathing, you might notice a sensation of internal energy. You can gently put your attention on that and rest your mind there, just being present with your own life energy, just enjoying the sense of being alive. As you become familiar with it, you start to depend on it to be there. In any circumstances, it becomes yours, something you can arouse, cultivate, and use for your own and other benefits as you move through your life. Katagiri makes it a little clearer. He says, keep turning the stream of mind away from your dualistic thoughts and inward to the energy of your life. That is our Zazen practice. Learn the technique of Zazen and then practice it again and again until technique is not technique and there is no subject that knows or object that is known. If you practice on a daily basis, your original energy penetrates unconsciously into your everyday life. And you can use that energy to develop your life, your total personality, in the scale with all sentient beings. It seems to me that this no separation of subject and object is what Dogen means by non-thinking, because at that time there are no words present at all. There is no discrimination of anything. There is just pure aliveness. Zazen offers the ideal situation and opportunity to develop your capacity for transmitting aliveness. When you engage in Zazen in that way, you are making an art of Zazen. Now let me just read the quote on today's printed program for the benefit of people who are hearing this talk and aren't here today. Katagiri said, if you continue to practice, finally you can see the realm of real reality where life is going like a flow of a stream and all beings are walking together, hand in hand, in peace and harmony. You feel your own human warmth and compassion, and you can deal with everyday life in a kindly, softly, and gentle way. Yes, it is possible. So when you are ready, jump in and join that flow of life as a Buddha. You will find a very simple life where you can make an art of the flow of life. Before I move on to the last part of my talk, there's one more observation I'd like to make. When we study Buddhism, we learn about the causes of human suffering, how the habits of our egoistic consciousness perpetuate suffering by creating obstacles to opening ourselves to the fullness of life. This is very important, of course, because there are ways that we can do things different, ways to create a better life. But we can't forget that while we are learning those things, the universe is already producing us from its own being. We, you and I, are art forms that the universe has created from itself. You are not a mistake. You belong in this world, and you carry the beauty of Buddha nature inside you. This is your natural presence. There is already something exquisitely sublime about you because you are here. So we can understand Zen practice as a way we can learn to attune to the beauty of what we already are, rejoice in it, and bring awareness of it into our everyday life as a creative art of living that benefits ourselves and those people around us. So finally, I've always appreciated the aesthetic of Asian arts. I feel drawn to the calligraphy, and particularly the Sumier technique of using a few strokes of ink in a brush to capture something's form and spirit. There's a long tradition of Zen people practicing these arts, and I had hoped that someday I would be able to do it too. And I finally got the chance. For the last year, I've been studying Chinese brush painting and calligraphy with Bob Schmidt at his Laughing Waters studio in Minneapolis. Bob is the artist who made the swirl on our Zen Center's logo. And he does offer workshops from time to time on making ensos, the Japanese Zen circle, and that's where I met him taking his course, one-day course. I know many people here engage in various Asian and other art forms, healing arts, athletic arts, martial, musical, fine arts, handcraft, tea ceremony, flower arranging. In addition to a Zen practice. So after I close, if you have a practice like that and you'd like to share about it, I encourage you to think about saying something later. For me, making of my art is a practice that occupies a middle ground between everyday life and spiritual practice. On one hand, I paint for my own pleasure. But on the other hand, brush painting and calligraphy force me to face some of the inner obstacles that limit me, and at the same time, give me opportunities to practice overcoming them. So a couple of examples. When I was a beginner, I had no expectations of myself. I was exhilarated just to be learning. It was thrilling to watch the ink-filled brush just touch the paper and see what happened. But then the desire to make something good came up. Once, after a few months of study, I finished working on something that was a little more ambitious than usual, and I was ready to sign my name in Chinese characters. No problem. Until my teacher said, "That's an important piece. Be careful." I panicked, and my hand started shaking. The stakes had never really been high before. But now I couldn't settle myself down. And so in the end, my signature was pretty wobbly. But I gave myself some degree of acceptance, and I said, oh, well, someday I'll look back at this, and I'll remember how it was for me that day. Once you've made a good beginning on something, the stakes go higher with each thing you add to it. I get attached to what I've done, and it's hard to deal with the risk of ruining it. So fear comes up. But there's no way to escape. I have to deal with my fear of imperfection and keep going. I have to accept the consequences, whatever they're going to turn out to be. This is very hard for me. The weakness in my personality becomes vividly obvious, and it shows me that I have to work on being brave. Fortunately, my teacher has also told me that calligraphy, which is strong and expresses your energy, even if it's imperfectly done, is appreciated more than lifeless characters that may be perfectly made. So that encourages me. But still, right now at home, I have a fairly large painting of a pine tree, and I haven't worked up the courage to put the calligraphy notation on it yet. And another example. Last spring, I took an all-day class on painting chrysanthemums with Bob Schmidt's teacher, who is Hong Zhang. Hong is a very calm and dignified master artist who studied in Shanghai. In a class, Hong demonstrates what we're to do by painting it himself, and then we try to imitate it. The final piece that day was large and fairly complicated. At the end of the day, Hong walks around to each student and gives some feedback. When he came to me, he spent a long time looking at my painting. Then very solemnly, he said, "This is not good." Yep. I could feel that hot energy of the fear of being humiliated just right there. But I interrupted it. To myself, I said, "No, wait. Let's not get trapped by praise and criticism. You really want to hear what he has to tell you. So turn that hot energy into something else. Let's use it to pay attention." So I listened. He said my painting was okay, but my calligraphy showed that I didn't understand how the individual strokes that make up a character are supposed to work in harmony with each other and with the other characters that they're near, or even across the whole page. Okay, I can work with that. Afterwards, that energy was still there, but now it felt good. It felt inspiring. I felt like I'd made a connection with it. Sadly, for the next person, she couldn't listen to what Hong wanted to tell her because she was very busy arguing with him and defending herself. He really tried, but finally he gave up and walked on. All disciplines, especially those with a teacher or a coach, and meeting in a particular place and following rules or traditions, put you into uncomfortable situations, and you have to respond. It doesn't feel good. But I think that learning to recognize and transform our inner obstacles through an artistic practice, done with the same principles we bring to spiritual practice, expands our capacity for refined activity in any situation we may find ourselves in. It helps us learn to move deeper into our lives, where we find the natural creativity of life. So, I've reached the end of my talk, and the floor is open to anyone who might like to share something about your own practice, or to ask questions, or make comments. Yeah.
Relate to your story about having your critique. I studied art for many years, and I remember being with a teacher I really respected, and for about maybe a year and a half, every other week there'd be a critique of our paintings, and he would rip mine apart.
Oh no.
And I just kind of kept plodding along. And then I had one project that I really put everything into. And I even had dreams of him coming in and instructing me on how to change something or to do something different or get a technique better. It was very odd, this connection with this particular teacher. And by the time I was done with it, I looked at that painting and I said, I don't care what he says about it. I like this. I like what I've done. And it's enough for me.
Yay.
So 4 a.m., 5 a.m., class was at 1:08. You know? So I went in, I stuck it up with everyone else's, and I just sat there with my very bored expression, waiting for him to come racing in. And he went immediately to my painting. Whose is this? Whose is this? You know. And he goes, and I thought, he's pointing at mine. And so I finally had my moment. But you know, of course, he just about fell over when I raised my hand. So it was good that I just let go of outcome. I let go. Good enough for me, finally. I wasn't trying to please him. Mm. It was good enough for me. And then it just worked. It just was really one of the best things I had done up to that point.
Mm.
But I will just add one thing about my profession. I work in shiatsu. And one of the things that I really enjoy about my shiatsu practice is working points and opening up and getting results and having the client be very excited about the result, but then showing them how to work those points themselves. Mm-hmm. So I don't become the end all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where they have to race to see me. I show them how to do
and teach them.
Mm-hmm. So with that.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Thank you so much. Yeah, Steve.
Well, I read this phrase, life is going like the flow of a stream, and all beings are walking together hand in hand in peace and harmony. And, of course, I can find times in my own life when I don't feel like I'm walking hand in hand in peace and harmony, and then I can find times where I don't feel like other beings are walking in peace and harmony. So, how does that... I mean, he obviously thinks he's saying something that is true, and how does he accommodate phenomena that don't seem very peaceful or harmonious, or beings in certain states? We can all think of those. I could come up with concrete examples.
Well, I think he's helping you reorient to a deeper place within yourself where you actually are in one universe where everything is connected and is moving together through a process of birth and death. And he's not really telling you how to solve your problems on the surface or how to get along with people. I think he's reminding you to go a little deeper, and when you approach the problem, to approach it from a deeper level as you think about what to do.
It makes me think of, there's a song, I forget who sings it, but it's on the radio now, popular. Bones, I think it's the name of it. And the lyrics are like, when the bones are good, the rest don't matter. It talks about how you can shatter, but anyway, when the bones are good, the rest don't matter. Makes me think of your talk.
Thanks.
I have a practice of Japanese tea ceremony. I've been practicing for several years now with a teacher here in the area. And looking back on it, I see a similar transformation that happens when we do any practice. When I started, I was in awe of the beauty of the ceremony, which is what initially drew me to it to begin with, but then to actually practice it in front of somebody is absolutely terrifying. There's a certain procedure we're supposed to follow, and a certain way to hold everything and move everything, and everything is in relation to everything else. Reminded me of your comment about how your characters are supposed to, each stroke is supposed to relate to each other stroke and to the whole. And it's the same thing with tea ceremony. And coming at it from ignorance, I was just fearful of my teacher reprimanding me. But as I practiced more and more and let go of this expectation I had to perform, I noticed that it wasn't my teacher reprimanding me at all. My perception was I was being reprimanded, but in actuality, she was just helping. She was instructing. She was showing me what needs to be done. And I really have nowhere to go with that other than just seeing that transformation in the way we practice just by practicing and just by giving ourselves to this practice. Whether it's ceremony or sumie or whatever we're doing, just giving into that is transformative itself.
You know, things that occurred to me when I was told that my work wasn't good, it felt like criticism, but then I realized something different about it. I realized that he was showing respect to me, that he was taking me seriously, that I had an intention to learn and get better, and he was offering me what I needed to be able to do that. And I felt I received it. Eventually, I was able to receive it with gratitude.
Vincent van Gogh, who never sold one painting in his lifetime, was being scoffed at, and no one could understand his art form. And thank goodness, you know, he didn't listen to people and throw his paintings away, because now look at how they're considered, you know, some of the greatest works of art. So he just persevered and just kept